This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Thank you very much for joining us on Keeping the Faith this afternoon. My name is Don Nolan. Steve Shoemaker is not with us. He's involved with the Martin Luther King celebration event today, this afternoon, and we are going to be a part of that, but not with Steve with us this afternoon. We have a guest this afternoon who I think many of you may know. He is a well-known figure here in town, Mr. Michael Ledoux. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Michael is, if you don't know, a city councilman for Champaign. I believe it's District 2, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And I think you've been at this for at least over two decades, you are unique among politicians and public officials, I think, to some extent. You're also a poet. And we're going to talk to Michael today about poetry, and in particular poetry as it has a bearing on the significance of this day, the celebration of Martin Luther King. And why don't we get started by reminding everyone that this is a call-in show. If you have any questions that occur to you during the course of the conversation with Michael, you can call in at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455 if you're out of the immediate area. So, Michael, we're going to be talking about your poetry insofar as it relates to the themes of Martin Luther King's life. And I thought what we'd do is get started by just asking just a few short questions, and we'll get straight to your poetry. I'm looking forward to hearing it. Why don't you tell us how you got interested in poetry to start with? Can you do you have a recollection or a memory of when you fell in love with words?
Well, I was fortunate to have been raised around my grandfather, who was a classical rhetorician, an authority on Cicero and Demosthenes and Periclean speech. He translated Greek and Latin and worked on the work of Cicero. And I guess I could say he was something of a mentor. I spent a lot of time with him, and we spoke of Greece and Rome and the power of language and the endurance of eloquence across the centuries. And I discovered Dylan Thomas and the sonnets of Shakespeare, and rich language was moving to me and memorable.
How early can you remember when you were
working? I think I knew about I'd have to say 6 or 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I was amused as a child and spent a lot of time thinking about the example of the great story of the pre-Socratic philosopher and legend who held the lantern aloft and who told the great Alexander to get out of his light. Mm-hmm. While living under a bathtub with a couple of dogs in a junkyard. And this was the man Alexander sought out as the wise man.
Mm.
And
well, you've been speaking truth to power ever since, right? In one way or another.
One way or another, yeah. One, not always heard, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you have had some unique experiences in your travels, if nothing else, and in your thinking about the themes of Martin Luther King and his life's work. Tell us a little bit about some of the themes that have most impressed you, and I think in particular you mentioned to me prior to the program your interest in oppression in Bangkok these days, in Thailand, and you seem to think that Martin Luther King would resonate with these concerns.
Yeah, it's apparent from the written record and by written record, I'm suggesting that Dr. King's speeches were preeminent in that written record, that his concerns were becoming more general, more global, more encompassing as he grew older. He became involved in discussions about international relations and policy, about economic and social inequity. The dialogue as he began it at the origins of the civil rights struggles in the late 50s was confined to confronting the abuses and brutality of white power codified in unjust law. And as he confronted that and overcame blocks of it at a time, by the late 60s, prior to his assassination, his concerns were becoming not only more global, but I think meaningfully more in accord with those concerns of his great mentor, Mohandas or Mahatma Gandhi. And I was thinking that to start this out today, rather than going directly to a poem that I had written in Atlanta at the King Center, I would start with something as far afield of the United States as Bangkok, Thailand. But it is universal in the sense that this is about the shunning, the exclusion, the condemnation of people diagnosed as HIV positive with full-blown AIDS in Thailand. They are shunned by their families. They are abandoned by their spouses. They are disowned by their children. They are fired from their jobs. They are shunted out of society. And one group of spiritual men, the Buddhist monks of Bangkok, have built structures to house them, to care for them, to offer them comfort, to ease them into the next plane of existence, and to dispense with their remains, since no one else will. And I think this resonates for people globally who face the many different kinds of oppression whose result are always the same: shunning, isolation, despair, and oblivion. And these men stand between those forces and the victims of AIDS in Bangkok. This is called Bed Check in Bangkok. Robed Buddhist monks glide noiselessly through rows of cots. Unlike the hooded Christian monks who, ringing bells down narrow European ways, marked days for dying townsmen crying, "Dead, bring out your dead," metronomically in plague years. There is no Defoe in Thailand yet remembering the faceless, no numerologist divining prophecy fulfilled. The monastery, by degrees more hopeful than an airport morgue, is only so at morning bed check as the monks address the dawn and those still capable of yawning, then weed their sickly garden of those gone. Buddhist monks alone find hostile purpose helping them to leave, transitioning the souls disowned by families and friends, but monks especially are, there or here, not blind to ends, and in the early years of AIDS built 7 ovens at their crematorium. Monks whose compassion was calibrated down from last comforts to efficiency expect accelerating rates of death, just as the vigor of their guests is calibrated down. Monks presume sacrality in rites of human entropy, aim for slowed decline in the dignity remaining to the hopeless, a spiritual triage before the yawning oven doors, a dignity at home derided, finally denied. No one yet, a Western journalist intones, has claimed the ash or boxed their bones.
It's certainly clear that that is a theme that resonates with King's own activities here in the States. You said earlier that you thought that Martin Luther King was working towards universal themes. What did you mean by that?
I think as he evolved and as his dialogue with his fellow citizens of the United States evolved, it became a dialogue more with the world. That was recognized early by the committee of the Nobel Prize committee that awarded him the Nobel Peace Prize. That was an international prize. Mm-hmm. That was not a prize for a distinguished Southerner. That was not a prize for a distinguished American or an American statement or statesman. That was a prize recognizing a global figure, mm-hmm. a man whose life was dedicated to addressing global themes. Yes, on the grassroots level. Yes, on a level so intimate. So intimate. Because there is nothing more intimate than to be the recipient of a bullet, and yet universal.
Many Americans, I think, don't realize just how well-known and followed King was, even in his own lifetime around the world. I've often wondered how King would have evolved. As you said, in his last few years, he was beginning to focus on economic issues and worker rights and protesting the Vietnam War. I'm curious how you think he might have evolved from there.
I think he would have become much more political in the sense that he would have addressed foreign policy. Mm-hmm. He had never, of course, he would never have divorced himself or his interests from domestic policy, but he began to become more and more sophisticated, as I hope a lot of us did then, about the relationship between domestic policy and foreign policy, and how inequities abroad and profiteering that support those inequities are a reflection and often an outgrowth of inequities at home. Mm-hmm. And he saw that relationship, and toward the end of his life, he spoke to that. Mm-hmm. And he was then, of course, a target of surveillance by J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, as he was perceived to be a deeper and deeper threat because of those involvements and those utterances.
Just so that we remind our audience, if you would like to call in to talk about these themes on Martin Luther King's celebration, you can call 333-9455 or out of the listening area at 1-800-222-9455. I understand that you have been to Atlanta and you've visited the memorial there. What effect did it have on you?
It was very profound because there was no one else there but me and the person I went with. It was a very, very hot day. It was in late summer. And late summer in Atlanta is nothing if not hot. And I was in a neighborhood that I had a personal connection to because a very good friend of mine is a direct descendant of the African-American businessman who built the shotgun houses on Auburn Street in Atlanta, in the historically black neighborhood. He actually, his forebear actually built many of those houses. I don't think he'd be embarrassed if I mentioned him. Alexander Hamilton, I think it's the fifth or sixth. Hmm. Well, Alexander Hamilton, the third or fourth, built those shotgun houses. And if you go to Atlanta, you can see the National Park Service signage that points all of that out. So I felt something of a connection to the neighborhood to begin with, in addition to just the general connection I have as an American concerned about the significance of the civil rights struggle that is symbolically embodied there. Mm-hmm. And the world of segregation that neighborhood once represented. But on that hot day, the air was filled with the scent of roses that Coretta Scott King had planted. There is a rose garden across the street from the Ebenezer Baptist Church and across the street from the King Center, where the reflecting pool surrounds Dr. King's mortal remains. And I put my hand atop the water in that reflecting pool and could feel the electric tension of the surface tension of the water. Perhaps it was because of the heat. Perhaps it was because of the great contrast between the temperature of the water and the temperature of the humid air and the intoxicating aroma of all those roses cooking in that hot sun. But I wrote a poem I called The Scent of Sweet Auburn.
Let's hear it.
There was a bomb in Gilead whose power Dr. King invoked, whose counterpart partaken of by him in death resides within the chiseled granite ark upon the water in Atlanta where he lies. Mortared into stone, the body of which all remains is bone and sanctity cannot remain. As water seeks its level until all that is low is filled and shines, so goes Dr. King, who cannot be held by granite. For no mortar is forever, and every seed is from within breached, hulled. The seed of Dr. King's sarcophagus, from which the wind carries a bomb from Atlanta to the rest of us, with the scent of roses, to the bowed black woman who recites and ends her prayers with, "Every goodbye ain't gone."
Do you do a lot of revising?
It depends. It depends on whether or not there are rough spots on there that when my eye scans them, it hurts. If it hurts, I got to smooth them out.
I remember a quote by Paul Valéry, "A poem is never finished, just abandoned."
That's true, because what happens with poems for me is that I end up carrying them around with me every day, and as I have a free moment, I might pull one out and scan part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you become, the poem assumes a life of its own independent of you, and it becomes like a roommate you have to get used to living with. And you work these things out with your roommate, the poem, and eventually you come to an accommodation and you leave each other alone.
Did you ever have a roommate that you've thrown out?
Only once.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. Oh, the abuses were egregious. It had to be done.
Now, when were you there in Atlanta?
Oh, let's see. That would have been in 2002.
Okay, so not that far away.
No, not that long ago.
We've just had a bit of a spat in the Democratic Party over Martin Luther King's legacy and the meaning of racism. It appears that Obama and Clinton have had to bury the hatchet about how they understand many of those issues. Do you think that we fully understand Martin Luther King's, the meaning of his message today? Is it clear or is it ambiguous?
Well, I don't think we fully understand it, because I don't think that he was afforded the opportunity to live to articulate his vision fully, or to fully embrace it and feel at home with it in the world himself. I think there is always a creative tension in the world of activism. There is a creative tension that exists between the individual who is committed to change and committed to helping others define justice collectively, as he was. And I don't think that if he were here today, he would tell you that he fully understood the message, because the message is always evolving.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to evolve with it.
Well said. I think the most profound messages tend to be relatively vague.
Yes, and this was a point made by Gandhi early in his career, and of course King was not only deeply inspired by the Mahatma. I believe that had he lived, he was a Mahatma himself. He was a great soul. We were deprived of him too early.
When you mention Gandhi, of course the doctrine of ahimsa or nonviolence inevitably comes up. I've often been intrigued with the question of the roots of nonviolence within the Christian tradition itself. Turn the other cheek and lay down your life for your neighbor. To what extent did King already understand that from a Christian perspective? I don't know if you know enough about his writings to say that, but he had a sense of spirituality that made him receptive already to Gandhi, yes?
Yes.
On the question of nonviolence. He was already prepared to do that.
I believe so, yeah. I've read biographical accounts of him. They are, of course, apocryphal and sometimes wishful.
To what extent is it rooted in his Christian faith?
I think it's squarely rooted in his Christian faith, but I think there is I think he recognized in it a universality that was attested to by the effectiveness with which Mahatma Gandhi, a Hindu, applied it to his circumstances and the injustices he was confronted by.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't just a Christian thing.
Mm-hmm. I understand you have another poem related to the general theme of faith and spirituality in Martin Luther King.
I do.
You want to describe that one to us?
Well, Dr. King, of course, never worked alone. None of us does. He was a leader, but a leader needs to be buoyed like a ship by a great sea of people prepared to do the work. And in that sea is a great, great tradition in the African-American community of deep spirituality, of deep commitment. And I saw this exampled in New York City. I was staying with a woman who was from Algiers, opposite New Orleans.
I was going to say, the Africa or the New Orleans Algiers.
Right? Yes, she was a Creole woman from Algiers, very, very spiritual, very, very deeply religious and prophetic woman who had settled in New York City and become a shop steward back in the violent era of the Ladies Amalgamated Garment Workers Union. She was an old garment district shop steward, and I was her guest. I met her on the train once going to New Orleans, and she invited me to come to New York and stay with her, and so I did. And when I was there, she said, "Now, don't you talk to anybody on the subway. Don't you talk to anybody on the buses." You know, and of course, I being a callow Midwestern type, I did anyway. I couldn't help myself. And it's amazing how people respond sometimes when they don't, you know, they least expect you to try to interact with them in New York City. But I guess I was on vacation and far away from home and thought it was worth the risk, and it proved to be. I remember observing all these people coming and going from the Bronx and from Brooklyn and from Harlem, coming and going to their jobs and going about their lives on public transit, because I was using the buses and the subways, and noticing the disparity of wealth distribution in Giuliani's New York. That's a good way to do it then, is to be on the subway and see how much money gets spent on the different subway stops.
So you witnessed the big cleanup.
I witnessed the big cleanup, and I witnessed just exactly how selective and targeted it was. Mm-hmm. And it was both.
Were in 42nd Avenue before or after it was cleaned up?
Before. Well, I call this Rapture in Harlem.
Okay.
It's a briefer one, but I was told I had to bring this along today. This was inspired by that woman and other women with a lot in common with her that I ran into in New York City. Powerful hands of a strong-featured black woman clutching a testament, reading her psalms on the subway at midday while praying for alms after rent and the phone and the children are fed. A token of good faith to lay in the plate slid poor down the spirit and traffic-filled pew of a long overtaxed Lenox Avenue to assure that when Jesus comes, he won't be late, unlike husbands, paychecks, buses, babies, and fate. So believers at underground subway stops queue for ascension in Harlem, a good street side view of Christ Jesus upon Lenox Avenue. And we're still waiting.
Black women have played at least as much of a role as black men over the course of the history of the civil rights movement. And some have been troubled by the big man theory of the civil rights movement, and Martin Luther King certainly filled those shoes beautifully. And I suspect if he were here, he probably would say, yes, I'm just a figurehead. There have been hundreds of thousands of black women, such as the one that maybe you met, I don't know, and others who have we owe more to than even me, he probably would say of himself. Would you agree?
Well, he'd have to, or he'd have been in awfully, awfully serious and irredeemable trouble. He was raised by such a woman, who was raised by such a woman, who was raised by such a woman, all the way back to probably Aunt Gola or wherever they came from. And his wife was such a woman. Hmm. And certainly Rosa Parks was. No one then or since would dispute that. And 40 years have elapsed since Dr. Martin Luther King was among us. And in that 40 years, there's been a huge dialogue about the role of women in the civil rights movement and since that Dr. King, had he lived, would have to have not only participated in but been a leading voice in. And I believe that as he was evolving, he, along with that dialogue over those years, would have evolved.
We're talking to Michael Ledoux on his poetry on the theme of Martin Luther King this Sunday. We have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Do you have a question?
I don't have a question. I do have a comment.
Sure.
However, for the poet, he has captured the sentiments of many African-American women. And please continue your power of observation. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Now, you, I believe, were recently involved in some activities over at University Place Christian Church. Is that right?
That's true, It's not all that recent now, unfortunately. It was a couple of years ago.
What was the event?
Well, we had two. Uh-huh. Yeah, two. But the most recent one was about, almost 2 years ago now. We had a Jazz Vespers, a reprise of the kind of spiritual expression that was afforded to jazz musicians in the 40s and 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you have a background in jazz? Are you involved in it at all, or is jazz in any way connected to your poetry?
Yeah, very definitely. I'm sort of an amateur jazz historian. Mm-hmm. My father was a jazz trumpet player. My mother was a classically trained musician, an operatic mezzo-soprano, and a child prodigy on the violin. Mm-hmm. So music has always been very, very much a part of my life, mm-hmm. and jazz has informed much that I've done with respect to writing and with literary aesthetics.
Now, I understand that one of your poems was very well received over there. What did you do at that event?
Well, at the first one, I read Rapture in Harlem and then a poem about...
The one you read earlier.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and then one about John Coltrane and Eric Dolphy at the Village Vanguard, which I did not bring with me today.
I see.
At the second, I read... I read a poem about Emmett Till and the extraordinary historical irony that of all the crimes swallowed up by the Tallahatchie River for 150 or more years, of all the crimes, of all the lynching victims, the rapes, the beatings, all the ugliness that that river had washed over at that point in history, at that point in time, Emmett Till's remains refused to stay down and were discovered, and this horrible crime became a cause and a call heard certainly across America, but arguably across the world, almost as though it were like the baby Moses floating down the river in the basket being found by the daughter of Pharaoh himself.
Tell us just a little bit about that event for people who don't know Emmett Till or where Tallahatchie River is.
Well, the Tallahatchie River is in Mississippi. That's the river in which the murderers of this young man, a child really from Chicago, deposited his body attached to a very, very heavy gin fan. And despite all odds, he rose from the water. And rose then into public consciousness. But I didn't bring that poem with me.
Well, you're being poetic about it.
Well, I'm making it up as I go, because I don't have that one with me.
We have a caller on line one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith. Do you have a question or comment? Hello?
Hello?
Hello? All right. Thank you.
I do have one about the slave burials on the plantation of the father of our country, however.
Mount Vernon.
Where, when you and I were speaking before the show, you and I have both been mm-hmm. and felt many of the same things, I'm sure. I went out east this past summer, determined to visit the slave cemeteries, both at Washington's Mount Vernon and at Jefferson's Monticello. I was met mostly with confusion and not particularly inspired by Monticello, but at Washington's estate.
Mm-hmm.
A different relationship was shown. A different kind of man was buried there.
Mm-hmm.
Different kind of experience. I was struck. I didn't know what to think because I had studied the Gullah burial practices and some of the burial practices of African Americans in East Texas, where in traditional slave and Reconstruction burial grounds, one can expect to find grave goods of different kinds.
Mm-hmm.
Talismans, charms, symbols of different aspects of the buried person's life and aspirations. There was none of that in evidence at these slave burial grounds. There was nothing.
They're completely unmarked.
Completely unmarked. Mm-hmm. In fact,
they're almost more moving in that regard.
Well, to the extent that I was inspired to write this, they certainly were for me.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly I was just a bit disgusted at Jefferson's because it's in the center of the tourist parking lot.
Hmm.
They built a parking lot around it,
hmm.
which I thought was extraordinarily disrespectful.
Well, in Mount Vernon, they still have some of the slave quarters a little bit further down the road. Isn't that right?
I think they're reproductions, but yes, they are there on the original sites.
Mm-hmm.
But Washington had a strange and complicated relationship with those who toiled on his estate, as did so many others in his station in life. It's very difficult for us in the 21st century to embrace without a little bit of a shudder the kind of perks and privilege that were exercised then. But we have to recall that it's part of who we are. It's part of who we are as Americans.
Mm-hmm.
We still wrestle with it. It is still one of the demons we seek to tame. It was certainly so to 18th century rebels who were resisting British rule.
Mm-hmm.
And they wrote a great deal that suggests to us their ambivalence about slavery and their roles in it.
The differences between Washington and Jefferson are a case in point.
Yes, they are. As is physically evidenced.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yes, and he doesn't really get a pass for that in the present.
No.
But he did provide for his slaves after his death. He established a trust fund. And in the peculiar realities of the times.
You're talking about Jefferson
now? No, I'm talking about Washington.
Washington, okay.
Washington provided a trust for those he had liberated after his death,
mm-hmm.
Some of whom are buried there. There are manumitted people buried mm-hmm. at that burial place.
Mm-hmm.
But let me read the poem, because we're addressing something historically, and in so doing we run the risk of missing something rather mystical about the whole thing,
mm-hmm.
something transhistorical. This is called Washington's Monument. And I have to point out to some listeners who may not know what Yoruba deities are. They are some of the gods of Western Africa,
mm-hmm.
Whose obeisance to whom I would have expected to see had there been grave goods at these burials.
Mm-hmm.
This is the poem Washington's Monument. Were Yoruba deities like fireflies here to spirit off the beads and feathered grave goods of dead slaves expirated silently from bondage? Even freed West Ford, attendant upon Washington, at liberty to go, returned to disappear into commingled charnel at Mount Vernon. Brickmaker's bones, joint carving, smoking, fowl hanging, cooking, serving bones, bricklayers, joiners, threshers, all sown here, compost to enrich the land that enriched Washington, and bound, though free, the manumitted who once served here. Their memories, the marble obelisks where solid stone is absent still. Willie Lee is here, who served the general in war to free the few among whom he was one, to lay down in this unmarked common grave of generations died in chattel, unremembered anywhere but haunted echoes, slave chants from the bottom land below on the Potomac, cleared by those whose sharp, clean bone-edged woods cleft soil and retired here to high ground at Mount Vernon, whose master lies encased in solid marble, disallowed to mingle with the soil they made. Quietly, we wait on higher ground among the trees with Washington at dusk for fireflies.
Lovely. Tell us more about Willie Lee. Do you know?
Well, I did at the time, but I haven't kept up with that. He was a gentleman who served with Washington for the 8 years. Of course, he served before and after, but for 8 years, Washington was on the road, on the run, a traitor, a rebel, a marked, hunted man.
The Osama bin Laden of his day.
Yes, he was, very truly, to those Tories and to those in England who didn't want to separate from the colonies. He was a terrorist and a traitor. And he could not go home and never did. He didn't get leave like people in a conventional army. He was not able to go home for 8 years. And this African-American man was with him, William Lee, attending upon him and attending with him and suffering some of the same privations he suffered and sharing them with them. They became very close. And when William Lee died, years after Washington, a manumitted fellow, he wished to be buried there.
Tell us the meaning of that term. A lot of
people he had been liberated from bondage. He had been freed from slavery.
And he came back.
Mm-hmm. The relationships between people in the 18th and 19th centuries are not as easy to understand as is sometimes supposed. They were not, after all, 21st century men and women. Mm-hmm. They weren't. Their experiences, their expectations, their horizons were unlike ours in many important ways. And I think it behooves us to understand the mystery of these relationships, to recognize that and try to work through that.
Right.
But that's the historical training I was exposed to, too.
Just to remind our listeners, if you would like to call in to talk with Michael Ledoux about his poetry or the themes of the afternoon, Martin Luther King's Legacy, you can call 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Michael, you have degrees in history, isn't that right?
That's correct.
What are your degrees in? I mean, what did you focus on?
Well, I focused a lot on philosophy.
Mm-hmm. History of ideas or philosophy straight?
History of ideas, which of course presupposes that you're prepared to familiarize yourself with a good deal of philosophy in order to understand how it has an impact on agents in historic change.
You said McGill, is that right?
I did study French intellectual history specifically and modern European history generally at McGill for a year.
Mm-hmm.
We had courses of study like an English university does that were a full year long. Both semesters and the break,
mm-hmm.
you would spend the entire year studying that subject in one course.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that, and as I, it became untenable for me to stay, so I came to the University of Illinois. I'm an Illinois native,
mm-hmm.
Wanted to be at the flagship university in our state, and so here I am.
You got a degree here?
I finished my master's degree at the University of Illinois in modern European history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, this has made you interested in what you've referred to as the complexity of African history and African-American history in particular. I think you think that this complexity is opaque to most people, even perhaps to African-Americans?
I think
it's kind of interesting because I recently heard Shelby Steele, a conservative black intellectual, distinguish between what he called in a recent book of his, what he called bargainers and challengers. Bargainers are those who come to terms with racism by negotiating with the oppressor and with the existing conditions that they live in, and the challenger confronts them, and that's always been a tension within the African-American community.
Yeah.
No doubt it's more complex than that, isn't that right?
Well, I think just speaking to the human experience, it would have to be. There are some people who obviously at different points in their lives have been one or the other and both. And then there are those who would suggest to both of us that that's family business,
right,
to which you and I are not privy.
Right.
I can't give you a real answer to that, mm-hmm, other than to speak as someone who has been a student of transhistorical human behavior patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And I would suggest that the complexity is ever present, and we have to deal with it among the living in the present, just as we try to understand the records left by those gone.
Now, you have also, you mentioned earlier, you've gone down to New Orleans on more than one occasion, I take it. And
many.
You have visited Congo Square, and I believe you have some work related to that. Isn't that right?
I do. I'm very disturbed by the post-Katrina world, not just in New Orleans, but in the United States, where it does not seem to be generally appreciated, since it never was, just how important New Orleans is in world history. I think it's ironic now, as news comes to us, that there is a serious discussion about reconstructing the statues of the Buddhas in Afghanistan that were destroyed by the Taliban.
The Banyan Buddhas, I think they're called?
Yes. They were designated a World Historic Site by the United Nations. Mm-hmm. And the effort now is not just talking about reconstructing them with reinforced concrete or even stone cutting, literally taking each piece of rock and determining, like a giant, super complex jigsaw puzzle, how they might be fitted back together.
And these are 900 feet high.
Yeah, that's a lot of rock.
As it is.
Reconstructing that at huge expense, probably international, and I have to look at New Orleans, a place where... The earliest encapsulation and most succinct expression of the African American experience was codified in ways that were exported to the rest of the world musically and culturally.
Mm-hmm.
The first real, and I've invited argument with this assertion with some other people who are experts, but It is my feeling and belief that what the rest of the world understands to be an African-American identity, independent of specific regional African survivalisms, and independent of the continent generally, and specific to the United States, comes from New Orleans. It was only in New Orleans, in the antebellum South.
Not Savannah, Charleston?
No. Those were places where playing drums and exhibiting African rhythmic patterns publicly and dance patterns and step line patterns were strictly forbidden and illegal and severely punishable. Mm-hmm. In New Orleans, uniquely, under the French initially, but the custom persisted.
Mm-hmm.
At a very special place in New Orleans, a very special and meaningful place, it was permissible weekly for the people from the different tribes and nations and language groups and cultural expression groups of the continent to gather and share with one another in a spirit of almost friendly competitiveness and sharing these different kinds of rhythms and patterns. And they became the origins of jazz. That became where jazz came from, and that became the place where, in some ways, an identity unique to North American experience emerged. And the irony is, one of the great historical ironies about Congo Square is that before either Caucasians or Africans came, the indigenous people, the Humas Indians, had designated this very space sacred ground to their religious rites and traditions. This was fertility rite ground. This is where fertility rituals were enacted long before white people or African people came to this continent. And when Africans and whites came to this continent, it was on that sacred Native American ground that these things took place. This conversation.
Let's hear your poem.
The concept of conversation on the concourse of Congo Square arose before the Africans arrived and overlay the ground with this name unknown to the Humas that first knew it to be sacred. And ever since, its celebrants put off their shoes or came with none to make new language without words on sacred ground, as though to set the sago palm and sweet magnolia ablaze with fire that illumines and does not consume. Bird people, intimates, and spirit creatures to the natives of this place chant interspecially, louder than truck traffic on Rampart Street, louder than thought, rhythmically, channeling the makers of footfalls on this square, uncountable, unforgettable, though nameless. This is the cradle, the burning bush, the hallowed ground. Here is the bridal bed of warring tribal gods of Africa, king and peasant, queen and slave, alive and enduring, font of all that is African-American, the real gold of Solomon, found in the crescent swamp of New Orleans, where no one thought to look and could not help but listen. Here the instruments were born, disguised, miscegenated, litigated, paginated in the courts, the churches, Pullman cars, and concert halls, the one-drop, two-drop, three-drop hybridized, who lost the tribes and languages and fused to make the beats that throb the pulse of all the world from here, this ill-kempt place of birds and waxy vegetation shining, speaking through the bodies of mulatto children disciplined by unseen hands that clapped in legions on Congo Square, footfalls stamped defiance again, then again, dying and living, bequeathing each life deeper than the last in disfigured, scarred, disposed of living past like breath that found trombones and trumpets, halts and quickens, traps to crack or coax snares, and finally sings of all that hitherto built and gathered until voice could be found.
Very good. It's obvious that you have mastered the art of distillation.
I sat on Congo Square and wrote that. I had waited for several years. I actually had the local winos show me where I could break into the city park, which was still closed after mm-hmm. Katrina, mm-hmm. and I crossed the yellow sheriff's line. And I crossed the path of fallen lighting fixtures and broken limbs that Katrina's winds had broken. And I went to Congo Square, as I had wanted to do for years, and I just sat there. And I could just feel these things. And it just started coming out.
I was going to ask if you had been there after Katrina.
Yeah, that's the only time I was there.
I see. You mentioned earlier the idea of identifying this as a World Heritage
yes, sir.
Site. Do you know of any movement in that direction?
I don't, but maybe we can start one.
There you go.
Maybe this is where it begins.
That's your poem is a good place to discover, I think, what many people don't realize is something verging on the sacred.
Well, it was sacred long before we went there.
Mm-hmm. What does Katrina mean to you?
Well, you ask as one rational person to another ostensibly rational person that question. To ask the poet what Katrina means mm-hmm. requires a poet's response, which is not altogether rational always. I think that... Well, first of all, that's as it should be, so don't misconstrue me.
Somebody said poetry picks up where reason left off.
Yeah, yeah, and mm-hmm. it may have been our old mutual friend Brooks McDaniel. Mm. With any luck, he'll hear this, but I wrote something about Katrina as the news was coming to us, and I guess that was 2005, yeah. I had been to New Orleans many times by then. It is like a home away from home for me, and it tore at my heart. to see the footage coming in from New Orleans.
Before you start, is Congo Square, I haven't been there since Katrina. Is it going to be the same?
Yes, mm-hmm. because there was nothing there to destroy, mm-hmm. and the spirits aren't affected by storm.
Area, yeah.
It's not even all that big. It is a section. It is a small section next to Rampart Street.
Well, I don't mean physically. Is it going to play as much of a role in the local community that it used to? It used to be a center place for culture, and now that much of the African-American culture there has been displaced and that diaspora has taken place, many people wonder whether or not you're going to have that same spirit that was there before. Are you well enough acquainted with how things are evolving there? I don't.
Yeah, you know, Congo Square is right in Louis Armstrong Park.
Mm-hmm.
And Louis Armstrong Park is, I believe, one of the sites where they have the annual right. Jazz and Cultural Heritage
right.
Festival.
It's quite an event.
So it will have international visitors. And it is clearly marked. And many, many people, particularly from Europe, know about Congo Square.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is a statue there given by a city in France, a beautiful bust. The French know it. There's a beautiful statue there of their former longtime guest, mm-hmm. Sidney Bechet, who was famous even unto infamy on Montmartre, playing at Bricktop's place and at the hot club of France.
Mm-hmm.
And helping expose the world to the sound and feel of New Orleans.
Well, I ask in preparation for your poem on related to Katrina, I'm just curious to what extent Katrina has changed the culture and not just the physical geography of the place.
Well, part of the tragedy, of course, is that the people who are the culture are a second diaspora.
Mm-hmm.
They are a second diaspora. They are all over the country now.
Mm-hmm.
Some will go back, many will not. To the extent that they don't go back, New Orleans will not ever be the same.
That was my question.
It will not ever be the same. It was so controversial when Ray Nagin said that New Orleans is a chocolate city, and a lot of us misconstrued him. We misconstrued him. In the wake of his having said that, as I've had occasion to think about it, I think, well, what's the chief thing New Orleans is known for? What is its chief export? The chief export of New Orleans, in many respects, worldwide, is the cultural expression of the African Americans that have lived there for generations.
Mm-hmm.
In effect, if you work with Nagin's awkward metaphor, you'd have to admit that if New Orleans is indeed a chocolate city, the chief export is chocolate, and that's gone now by and large.
Painful observation.
I'm hoping that people can come back. I hope they have something to come back to.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if this were made a World Historical Site and studied and appreciated for exactly what it is as an outgrowth of what it has been, I think that there would be more support for recreating and cherishing this jewel of North America.
Tell us about your poem on Katrina.
Well, I wrote this, obviously, I'm sure so many viewers saw the horrifying footage coming in from not so much the effects of Katrina, but the effects of corruption, misappropriation of funds, deliberately unkept promises of protection, deliberately ignored erosion of the delta that had historically protected New Orleans from storm. New Orleans, remember, was not hit by Hurricane Katrina. Katrina veered right. Katrina veered east and missed New Orleans. What happened with New Orleans was the failure of the infrastructure that was supposed to keep back Lake Pontchartrain.
Mm-hmm.
Lake Pontchartrain is what destroyed the Ninth Ward, not mm-hmm. Hurricane Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
But let me go to the poem. It's called Katrina's Eye. Flesh under cover, under siding, tires, framing, fish. Crumbling brick, broken dish, blackens like New Orleans cooking, blackened catfish, blackened prospects, blackened man-child, broken wife.
bloated child staring in rictus, bulging eyes wild, unblinking over flies that alone among survivors have enough to eat. Slave ship manifests entombed for 20 generations in New Orleans are awash, while descendants of the names are manifest in dead or desperate flesh trapped under attic eaves, pressed for years against glass southern ceilings, ending thus, pressed hard against eaves without an axe, to be searched out by rescuers arrived in time to disinter them from their homes, their tombs, their circumstances, homes in New Orleans, above ground crypts in the cooking pot of August and September's sun. Never were too little and too late, so small, so overdue for those undone, looking toward an end to chaos, waiting passers-by, secured a few remains, tethered them to trees, flagging them for retrieval, rolling, nodding in the water's rhythm, waving over Congo Square, the roofless church where rhythm-married blues, where chained slaves murdered in Atlantic waves were witnesses in spirit only. Force 5 rage, blown fear and thwarted hopes, aspirated toward shore, a withering great sigh, the unrequited love and anger in Katrina's eye.
Very impressive. We have about a minute and a half. I understand you have a poem on the Buddha reconstructed statues and also on the Garwood Nursing Home. Do you have a short one that you can leave us with?
Well, I have a short one. It's it has a tie to Champaign-Urbana, too, because the designer of the memorial on at the Marah Federal Building in Oklahoma City was, I believe, a U of I alum.
Mm-hmm. We have 60 seconds.
Yeah. Now, we're not going to have time.
all right. Well, if you would like to find out more about Michael's work, how might they hear you or get in touch with you? Do you do readings locally?
I do, yeah.
Where do you usually go?
Wherever I'm invited. Sometimes where I'm not invited.
Michael, I very much appreciate your joining us, and I'm so glad Steve asked you to be on. I'm sorry Steve can't be here. Steve is also a writer and a poet, and he was going to share some of his with you, and it's too bad we didn't get to hear both.
Well, he and I can do that. We can still do that.
Do that sometime. Yeah. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for listening on Keeping the Faith today, and we'll see you again next week. This is Don Nolan. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Every good story comes to an end, but in some stories, the end is just the beginning. It takes a special kind of writer to create a believable apocalypse, and right now there are a lot of them. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, Apocalyptic Fiction, new stories about the end of the world. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 on WILL Urbana.
On February 5th, we're conducting a fun drive, and we expect it to last 1 day, 12 hours, really. Just long enough to raise the funds needed to pay for a month's worth of programs on WILL Radio. It's possible with your help. So get into the Mardi Gras spirit and tune in at 7 a.m. February 5th, Fat Tuesday, for our first ever 1 day fun drive.
They say les bon temps roulés.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy and not as cold, a low around 7 degrees, with southeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with the high around 30 degrees, blustery with south winds 15 to 20 miles per hour and gusting. Tomorrow night, snow likely and patchy freezing drizzle possible, 1 to 2 inches snow accumulation. The low in the lower 20s with southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour and gusting. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.